Washing Tech.
Hey, it's Joe, and I don't have to tell you, relationships are critical in Washington. But how do you A, find out who the key players are, and B, figure out how to reach out to them? Well, I want to tell you about Leadership Connect. It's been an absolute lifesaver for us as we expand our operations and outreach here at Washing Tech. Leadership Connect, it's the digital service used by top federal contractors and government affairs leaders to contact decision makers and develop those strategic relationships. Visit leadershipconnect.io and join the community. I love it, and I'm 100% sure you will too. That's leadershipconnect.io. Try it now.
These initiatives on their face, they seem like great plans of action, right? But again, we have to take a look at how this impacts everyone. And unfortunately, that hasn't been done.
Welcome to the Washing Tech Policy Podcast.
From Washington, D.C.
with Joe Miller.
Joe Miller.
Hey, everyone. Hope the summer's going well, despite the obvious. What are you doing for summer vacation this year? Is it even possible? We may do something local or semi-local, like go see the Natural Bridge in Virginia. It's supposed to be an animal safari down there too. Jason Urenz was telling me about down there, so check that out. In any case, just want to let you know we're restructuring the format a bit here and eliminating the news segment for the foreseeable future. At least I've really been overextended the last 5 years trying to do everything on my own, and the time has come, I guess, to make sure I'm taking care of myself and not burning myself out. So, and I struggled with this because it's important for me to stick to my guns, deliver what I promise, but doing all this on my own over the course of 237 episodes is really starting to take its toll. So, and it took me 12 hours to produce a few episodes back, and these episodes were only 20-30 minutes, so that was kind of the point where I had to take a step back and realize that it's not going to be possible for me to deliver a quality product, and not just the podcast but other programming that we're trying to do here at the Washington Center for Technology Policy Inclusion, which is our new name. Washing Tech is our DBA, and 12 hours a week is time we really need, especially since we still only have one employee, myself. So that is what's going on, and I'm really not convinced that you even want a news update, because they're kind of a dime a dozen, right? With our newsletter, we get a decent click-through rate, better than most. But even with that click-through rate that's three times, the average nonprofit, most of the articles aren't being clicked. So it's probably the same thing with the newscast. So I've got to figure out better ways to deliver value. We can let NPR do their five-minute hourly news update. You and I were reading the same thing, so I just don't think it's necessary to have to subject you to general stuff you may not even be interested in. Before we even get to what the title says, which is the whole reason you decided to listen in the first place. So maybe one day we'll go back to doing the news at the top. Maybe we'll have someone do it for us. That'd be cool. Have a reporter at the top do it, perhaps. But we're going to need to press pause on it. So we'll still release the weekly episode with the exception of holidays and maybe a few other episodes here and there. And we'll still be the most diverse and inclusive tech policy platform around. Maybe I'll do some commentary at the top here. That seems doable. That being said, and we're still going to do the music, of course, because this is my beat. My guest today is Henry Greenidge, fellow in residence at New York University's McSilver Institute for Poverty Policy and Research. Previously, he led state, local government affairs and public engagement for Cruise, the GM subsidiary focused on autonomous vehicles. Prior to that, Henry held legal, policy, budget, and government affairs roles in D.C. during the Obama administration and served in senior leadership positions for the New York City Department of Transportation and the New York City Mayor's Office. He strongly believes in serving the community and and he's done a lot. Lots of accolades. Henry Greenidge. So how's it going up there in my hometown?
Okay, it's very different. It's a different feel to the city. You know, even walking outside of my house, I don't feel as safe just because you don't know what you're breathing in. The air quality, you care about that now. As people have started to come outside, you know, that's definitely an area of concern. And so all the things that made New York so great, you know, the nightlife, the restaurants, the parks, being part of this sort of active community, those are the things that cause most fear in my household, at least. And so it's a very different New York, you know. I think we've got a long way to go. And the fact that these coronavirus numbers continue to rise in other places is concerning. You know, we did well and sort of beat that back a bit. But now it's, you know, the part that gives most concern is that, you know, we're getting a little too complacent. So,
yeah,
I'm hoping things will turn out the best. It's scary, though.
Have you been over to Hudson Yards yet?
Yeah, I've totally been to Hudson Yards. I've seen the staircase exhibit, the vessel. My daughter and I had plans to visit the Edge, which is going to be the highest looking point in the Western Hemisphere. But the coronavirus impacted that. And so we've been forced to cancel our plans.
So it's going to be higher than One World Trade?
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us about what you've been working on, Henry. I remember when you were working in former FCC Commissioner Meredith Baker's office all those years ago, and you've come a long way since then. You have a new NYU fellowship. I think you worked for the mayor for a while, if I'm not mistaken. Did you work?
Yeah, that's right. We met many years ago, Joe. Yeah. And I had a great experience working for Commissioner Baker, and a lot of respect for what the FCC attorneys do there. I think that, you know, for me, I was looking for something where I could really demonstrate an impact, and was privileged enough to work for two transportation secretaries under President Obama, and really got to understand transportation and mobility and its impact on people. During that time was the Recovery Act, and so we were working to get America back to work, and I was able to understand how local governments worked, and I was seeing what worked and what didn't, right? And so I had this focus on innovation and saw what government did and didn't do, and then had an opportunity to go over to the tech side and work on autonomous vehicles, and realize that, you know, we have a tremendous opportunity through technology. Technology allows us to revisit some of the mistakes that we have made in the past. And so the transportation landscape, as you well know, Joe, was built in a fundamentally broken way. And that is because people were left behind. They were marginalized. And so with new technology, AI, data analytics, you've got drones, autonomous vehicles, electric vehicles, you can revisit that and you can engage with people in a way that never happened before. And so my fear is, though, that, you know, we are so focused on building this technology and deploying these solutions with the mindset that they are for everyone, that we are forgetting that people have been marginalized, and the way that we've been doing things is incorrect. And so what I'd like to focus on with my fellowship is bringing some of the issues to light that have been largely ignored. And that is the concerns of Black Americans in this country. And so when you have technology, you want to make sure that you are engaging with the Black community, that the technology serves their purpose as well, and that you're doing it in a way that is responsible, and that you understand that when you're talking to folks, you're talking to folks who've largely been ignored, and that, you know, maybe your solution is helpful, but that might not be the first thing that they want for their community, right? And so I think that these are major issues. I think the coronavirus has given a lot of these technology companies an opportunity to demonstrate their technology, and you are seeing how, you know, delivery service, grocery and package delivery services can now be done through apps. You can see some of the mistakes that the TNCs made in not engaging. You can see that there's opportunities to engage, right? And so this moment has given us this real opportunity to sort of set things right. But we must do so in a way that's responsible. We've got to acknowledge the past, right? And we've got to talk to people. And that often means having some uncomfortable conversations.
So, you know, when it comes to, first of all, I agree with you 1,000%. You know, when we're dealing with equality achieve, trying to achieve equality in this country, legislation has gotten us part of the way with the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of the 1960s, as well as the American Disabilities Act much later. So we're finally at a place where, decades after the Montgomery bus boycott, when lawmakers are perhaps taking transportation issues a little more seriously. They've gotten the molasses out, which is ironic since so many more people are now working remotely. But tell us about the current transportation funding bill, Henry, and how it measures on improving equity in transportation.
Let me take a step back first. What's important to recognize is that some of the pieces of legislation that you mentioned, they were successful and they helped in a way that the criminal justice system did not. There are many cases, and then the case law in transportation is scary. You know, you've got Plessy versus Ferguson, which gave way to the Jim Crow laws. You've got other cases out there. You've got Buchanan versus Worley, which in fact helped blacks, because it made the fact that you can no longer prevent blacks from renting and buying properties, right? And so you've got a system that has failed us largely, right? And you've got the legislators who sought to prevent a lot of the case law from moving forward. Now, what's key to understand with transportation is that, you know, we've had bills in our past like T21, we've had Safety Lou, and they had equity in their name, but when it came down to ensuring that Black Americans actually did receive equitable transportation funding, they failed to do that largely. And so what we do have now is an opportunity with the latest transportation bill, in that it seeks to prevent pollution. Climate justice is a huge issue affecting Black Americans. We see the effects with the coronavirus. You know, we understand, and looking at the numbers, that African Americans in this country were impacted more than any other race, and that's because of pre-existing conditions, right? And those pre-existing conditions exist because of the transportation landscape and the housing landscape, right? And so with this legislation, you can actually take steps to curb a lot of that. And I'm happy to see the climate justice reforms in there. However, there is still inadequate funding for public transit, and that is key. You know, we have been a car-centric focused society. We are focusing on highways, and yes, our highways are in fact crumbling, but public transit is the way people get around, specifically lower income people and a lot of Black Americans. And so we need to actually continue to invest in our public transit systems. We've seen with the coronavirus that revenues have gone down, and that's because people have stayed at home. Well, the federal government needs to step up, and this bill is an opportunity to do that. I think they have taken some steps, but other steps need to be taken to ensure that we have an equitable future.
So what are these open streets initiatives I keep hearing about? Increased calls for car-free cities and tech companies stepping up in some areas and others not so much. Tell us about these initiatives and what you think the impact these and other changes will have on our communities.
Yeah, so these initiatives, open streets, in New York, they've got something called street seats, and they've expanded that to where restaurants now have seating in both the roadway and the sidewalks. These initiatives have been a planner's dream, right? And you know, I'm not a planner by training, but this allows folks to really participate in active transportation. It allows folks to sort of reclaim the roads away from cars and have this notion of sharing, right? But again, what we want to do is ensure that this means equity and access for everyone. And I think that implicitly, because our ecosystem has experienced systematic racism, to put forward these programs without a lot of thought into the impact is a mistake, and it's premature. So when you're opening up the streets, right, and they are for everyone, we do have to look at what that means for different segments of the community. We do know that police departments have treated blacks poorly. And so do we want to encourage people to now be out in open streets when you have a police department that has had issues systematically, right? What about the communications involving these open streets initiatives? initiatives, have these departments of transportation talk to the community to let them know what's happening. Why are their streets closed, right? Why are they being encouraged to come outside in the wake of coronavirus, right? How are the seatings at restaurants that we see here in New York, how is that being approved? What does the process look like? So these initiatives on their face, they seem like great plans of action, right? But again, we have to take a look at how this impacts everyone. And unfortunately, that hasn't been done. And a lot of that is because the representation hasn't been there. You know, I've been working in transportation for over 10 years. I'm one of few Blacks, very few Black males are in the industry. That perspective is needed so that as these planners put forward these policies that are supposed to benefit everyone, they are taking into account some of the perspectives that they've largely been missing.
We're talking about transportation access and how it ties in with tech policy. Stay with us. So in the wake of the civil unrest due to the killing of George Floyd, many tech companies have released statements in support of the Black community, some going as far as publicly supporting Black Lives Matter. What is your sense of how this movement, how can I put this, how this movement has impacted urban technology companies, that is, companies who focus on deploying their tech in cities?
Yeah, thank you for this question, Joe. And so part of my work at McSilver Institute is really highlighting these issues with transportation and urban technology at large. So when I say urban technology, I'm referring to, you know, everything from micro-mobility, scooters, electric vehicles, autonomous vehicles, drones, all of these technologies that provide solutions to these really complex problems, right? And so the killing of George Floyd is something that our nation won't soon forget. This is a moment for us, and it's a moment for particularly for white people, because many of them have acknowledged that racism does in fact exist in their world and that they've been complicit, right? And so this allows us to have conversations about what it looks like to really be an ally and what it looks like to make measurable change. So a lot of companies have stepped up. They've released these statements acknowledging some of the ills that have impacted the African-American and Black community, right? But we have to take a step deeper to see how they play a role in this systematic racism. You know, unfortunately, it's not enough to just step up and issue a statement, right? You have to take a look internally. I think a lot of these companies are lacking diversity. They lack diversity not only at the staff level, but at the leadership level and on their boards. And so they really need to take a look at how they can improve that. And then since we're talking about technology, we have to acknowledge that, number one, we all have biases, right? And we all are in this systematic racist system. So you have to actively take steps to combat that. And if you don't, you risk putting forward technology that includes a lot of that racist thought process and those biases, right? And so what companies need to do is they have to acknowledge the existence of algorithmic bias. And that is bias in the way that they are developing their technology due to humans who are actually doing the coding and the programming, right? These companies need to come together and work with their employees and develop racial equity statements. What do they stand for? What are their values? What are they trying to put out there in the marketplace? They need to actually hire diversity officers and empower them to talk to senior leadership, not just hire one person who sits there who really can't make meaningful change. They also need to actively engage with the public, and tech companies are notoriously terrible at doing that. They have to hire the right people to do that. And in many cases, those people need to come from the communities in which they are seeking to operate. There are many things that these companies can do and should be doing. And if they do not do it, they risk adding to a system that has historically marginalized people. And this is an opportunity for us. And I think this is a a reckoning for a lot of these companies. I think that behind the scenes, a lot of these companies are scrambling to figure out how to address much of what I just discussed. The biggest piece of advice that I have is to not lean on their own understanding. There are experts out there. There are companies out there who've long been doing this work. There are advocates. There are urban planners who, and many of them women, I might add, Joe, who have been very impactful in this space, who actually have solutions that are ready to be put forward right now. They have frameworks for how to operationalize equity. And so we should take a look at some of the work that's already been done and then acknowledge that this is work. This is what needs to happen to improve our society, to ensure that everyone is included and everyone is not left behind.
Yeah, and there's a lot that we can do. I mean, I don't know how many national civil rights organizations have received funding, but certainly a lot of that can go into our communities. And certainly the focal point should be, I think, creating jobs as opposed to moving headquarters. We could do more. And when we're talking about white people, hopefully those folks who are so angry right now, hopefully they'll start to see how these systemic problems affect all of us and how they're being used to manipulate all of us. What are some final ideas you'd like to leave with us before we close in? Where can we find you online?
Absolutely. So you can find me at henrylgrinage.com is my website. I'm also very active on LinkedIn and Twitter. You can reach me by simply doing a Google search, Henry L. Grinage. Again, I'm at the McSilver Institute for Poverty Research and Policy. And so some final thoughts are this. We have this amazing moment here. What we have to do is acknowledge the past and move forward in a way that includes everyone. We really have to drill down on what we mean by equity and access. These are terms that have been thrown around for decades, right? But we have to figure out what that means, particularly for African Americans. And that means engagement. Engagement by those who, quite frankly, have the power and the privilege. What they have to ask themselves are, what are they willing to give up? You know, and I think, to be fair with you, Joe, I think this is a white issue that we as Black Americans have to deal with. And so we have to help them in dealing with this issue and, you know, be open to working with them. And so I'm happy to help lead this conversation. Part of my work with McSilver Institute is really bringing light to some of these issues that really haven't been discussed and highlighting the work of others. As I mentioned, there are a number of folks who've been working on these issues, particularly African-American women, a lot of them in California, but some as well on the East Coast, and really giving them a platform because I think there are some great ideas out there.
Henry Greenidge, fellow in residence at NYU's McSilver Institute and a rising star in this space. Henry, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Joe.
And that concludes episode 237 of the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you like what we do here, we'd love to hear from you. Please take a moment, leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. It helps people know what they can expect from the show and really helps us out. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you back here next week. Take care. Washing Tech.